ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Natasha Mitchell here with Big Ideas, and there's pretty much nothing bigger than the puzzle of the universe itself, right? So, hell, let's dive in. What explains everything in this crazy cosmos of ours, from planets down to the teeny tiniest particles and us in between? Well, physicists are on the case, but so are philosophers, like Karim Turbo. He's an associate professor of philosophy of science at the University of Bristol. He specialises in physics, and physics has two big theories to help explain the universe. There's what happens at the big end of town, like the force of gravity acting on whopping big planets, the expansion of the universe. Einstein's theory of general relativity can help explain those things. Then there's the tiny end of town. So how forces act at the level of subatomic particles. That's explained by the theory of quantum mechanics. Things get pretty weird down there. But this is where the battle for a grand theory of everything in the universe begins, because quantum physics and general relativity do not tango together. They're at odds with each other. Can philosophy help? Let's find out. We're joining Karim with host Sally Davies, the executive editor of Eon Media, which hosts these fantastic Sophia Club philosophy events in New York, in Melbourne, and this one is coming from London.
We're going to be discussing tonight, Karim, phenomena that unfold across billions of years. But I'd like to start this evening at a more human scale. So just taking us back to just under 100 years ago, to a cold October in Belgium, 1927. And this was where the fifth Solvay Conference on Physics unfolded. And this was a gathering of the greatest physicists of the day to discuss the double revolution that had unfolded in the first quarter of the 20th century. On the one hand, you had Einstein, the Swiss patent clerk, who had wowed the world with his theory of gravitation and general relativity, which showed that time and space were not absolute quantities, but in fact were incredibly bendy and relative to the position of the observer, which flew in the face of 200 years of Newtonian physics. And it would ultimately go on to lay the foundations for modern astronomy, for most of what we know about the universe, black holes, the Big Bang. More on that later. But this wasn't the only game in town at the Solvay Conference. On the other side of the ring, you had an even more disconcerting, equally profound revolution unfolding almost contemporaneously. This was championed by the likes of an avuncular, cheerful Danish physicist known as Niels Bohr. And this was, of course, quantum mechanics, quantum theory, which suggested the world was even more bizarre than it looked like through the prism of general relativity. You could have matter and light behaving as both a particle and a wave at the same time. You could have particles separated by light years of distance interacting faster than the speed of light. And you could have matter existing in multiple states at the same time, raising the question of whether anything existed before there was somebody there to see it. Einstein found this deeply disconcerting. He didn't like the idea of a lack of an objective reality. And he even described quantum theory later as it reminded him of the system of delusions invented by a particularly intelligent paranoiac. So the Solvay Conference was this watershed moment of bringing together, trying to reconcile these two profoundly important theories. On the one hand, general relativity dealing with celestial bodies at vast distances and quantum theory dealing with minuscule bodies smaller than an atom. And here at the Solvay Conference, you had the titans of physics as well as the Young Turks. So some of these names we're going to return to later. Bohr and Einstein, of course, but Wolfgang Pauli, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, Marie Curie, the only woman present, Paul Dirac and Max Planck. And 17 out of the 29 of those invited would ultimately go on to win the Nobel Prize. So this was a high point of scientific inquiry in some ways, but also there's a certain poignancy to this moment because it is in between the wars, and very soon, in 10 years, the brutality of the Nazis would cause many of these thinkers to go into exile, and it would mark the decisive shift of progress in physics from taking place in Europe to being in the United States for much of the 20th century. So with this kind of rich backdrop, Karim, I want to hand over to you to ask, have we made much progress in the 100 years in reconciling general relativity and quantum theory. And why does this work matter in terms of helping us understand the nature of our universe?
Thanks, Ellie. So in some ways, yes, some ways, no. I mean, I think one way of understanding progress is understanding the problem better. And in that sense, we undoubtedly have made huge progress. So it's almost 100 years, as you said. General relativity really reached its kind of precise formulation around 1915 with Einstein's work, quantum mechanics in the 1920s. So almost 100 years from this point. And people recognized that there was a kind of tension between them, famously called the two pillars of modern physics. And the question was, could we reconcile them whilst keeping the kind of structure intact? And to some extent, we're beginning to understand that it is possible, in principle, to reconcile them. But the project is, every step becomes more and more complex and more kind of mountainous. And so there are approaches to quantum gravity that have been developed now for a long time, particularly most famously string theory and something called loop quantum gravity. But these aren't finished theories, and we're still 100 years later, not completely satisfied about where we are and where science is.
So when you say quantum gravity, what I understand you to mean is you're talking about the fact we know gravity works across these vast distances, but we also know that those same bodies that are subject to gravity are also subject to quantum effects. But when you try to explain gravity using quantum theory, it just doesn't add up in some way.
So, I mean, I think it depends what we mean by gravity. So if you think about this glass of water, this is acting under gravity. It has water in it. The water is described by quantum mechanics. But we can describe things like this glass of water or things like particles in a particle accelerator because the gravity is very weak. The thing that where things become really difficult, really problematic, is when you have very, very dense matter in particular. So the two situations which we think quantum gravity will become particularly important are the very, very early universe and the kind of final stages of a black hole, so close to the kind of very, very dense, very strong gravity, but also quantum phenomena becomes relevant. So if we keep gravitational systems away from this regime, we can kind of understand how they work. So we have a very good, very well-tested theory of gravity. We recently detected gravitational waves. We have very good theories of particle physics. Higgs boson was detected, I guess, just over 10 years ago now. The problem is that there's a mathematical problem about getting the formulation or the general relativity and quantum mechanics to be unified in one theory. But there's also an empirical problem that to be able to test this theory, we'd have to get into this regime of really, really dense matter, really high curvature that you find only at the very early universe and in black holes. And it's very difficult for us to get any, or for scientists to get any data to test them.
So talking of the universe and black holes, it's fair to say, isn't it, that we know of certain phenomena that exist that are kind of sending us signals that the way we understand physics is incomplete. There's contradictions, there's paradoxes, and they're giving us clues that there's some regime that perhaps unifies these theories or perhaps goes beyond it that kind of explains the world at a more fundamental level than the explanations we currently have. What are some of these puzzles that are perplexing physicists and philosophers today?
So I think I would probably say that there are four or three, depending on how we count them. So there's two problems of infinity. Let me talk about they're both quite hard. I'll talk about the slightly easier one first. So the first one is really the problem of the infinities with general relativity.
Can I pause you? You say infinities. I mean, how many infinities are there?
Quite a lot, actually. So really, there are two different ways in modern physics where it appears that quantities that the theory predict become infinite. One of them is in general relativity, we find that in these areas where we have very, very high curvature.
And by curvature, you mean the curvature of space-time
exactly.
Caused by very, very big masses?
Or it can actually be gravity itself could curve itself, which is even stranger, so gravitational waves. But usually we'd think about this as the early universe or the matter of a black hole mm-hmm. curving space-time to such an extent that the theory, in some sense, predicts its own demise. It predicts that a quantity which we think we could measure. So if you imagine an astronaut with a kind of device to measure the local curvature, they fell into a black hole, the theory predicts that this device would measure infinity. So that's one way in which we think modern physics is kind of telling us itself that it's incomplete. Another problem is in quantum field theory, particle physics, that the way that we calculate quantities, I mean, Dirac himself was actually very upset about this problem. It was found that the particular approach that we take to summing up the series of different terms in a kind of framework that Feynman actually invented to do diagrams, it adds up to when you take the sum, it goes to infinity. And there is a way of dealing with this in some quantum field theories, but the story that we have at the moment is that we really need something else coming in from the outside for the full theory to complete it at the kind of very, very high frequencies. So there's two problems with infinities. There's also a problem of time that I think we'll talk about later. There's quite a few problems, actually. So another problem is the problem people may have heard of something called dark energy. So there's an extra, not fully understood kind of factor in the universe that doesn't act like matter. It acts almost like the opposite of energy. And it's ripping the universe apart, just about as we speak. So we're just entering a phase of the universe's evolution where the dark energy will begin to dominate. And we don't really know what it is. It acts very unlike matter. So there's another reason, at least I think, that we need to find something more general to be able to understand how the theories we use today to give a complete description of the world. And the final problem, I think I'm now on five problems, is the one we started off with. See, there are different types of theories. There's classical theories and quantum theories. And what they were doing in the 1927 Solvay conference was really refining the kind of algorithm or the recipe to turn classical theories into quantum theories. And so at that point, they'd really made huge steps in turning Newton's mechanics into a quantum theory. And later, they were able to turn something like Einstein's special theory of relativity or a slight generalization of that into a quantum theory. And one of the great kind of puzzles is why, when we try to apply the same recipe to general relativity, we don't immediately be able to kind of derive a theory of quantum gravity.
And just to clarify, so Einstein first came up with special relativity, which works quite nicely with quantum mechanics, but it's general relativity that remains unresolved 100 years later. So what is the role for philosophers in all of this? So, I mean, the Solvay conference had physicists, as far as I'm aware. They didn't have philosophers present. How can philosophers help here? What's their or your job in this inquiry?
So I think, like many jobs, over time, who does which parts of it changes. So if you go back long enough, and we'll talk maybe a little bit about this later, there wasn't really a strict distinction between physics and philosophy, and people worked in the kind of natural philosophy, which involved ideas from both. But around the 20s, there were professional philosophers of science that did have lengthy kind of correspondence and interaction with scientists. But the scientists themselves were also richly trained in philosophy. And so there was a dialogue at that period. And what really happened in the period after the war, is that philosophy and physics in particular kind of went their separate ways. And I think, like most breakdowns of relationships, there's fault on both sides. So physics became more instrumental, more focused on experimental results. Philosophy became more inward-looking, focused on language. And it wasn't really until the kind of, I guess, 70s or 80s that philosophers and physicists started talking to each other again. And now there's beginning to be a really rich interaction, and physicists and philosophers meet together, talk about problems that they both are interested in. They share different kind of, philosophers are very good at conceptual analysis, precision, arguing. Physicists are obviously very good at maths and physical reasoning. And so often you can find that you can help you solve each other's problems, and philosophers and physicists can now collaborate more and more towards kind of interdisciplinary work that cuts between the two.
I mean, not all physicists agree, obviously. Stephen Hawking famously said that philosophy is now dead because of the advances in science. But I'm curious to know, going back to some of these foundational puzzles in cosmology, what are some of the orthodox, if anything within physics can be called orthodox? I mean, I think a comedian once said there was speculation, wild speculation, and then cosmology. But how is it that mainstream cosmologists and physicists kind of go about resolving these paradoxes? What do they propose could solve them?
So, I mean, it depends on which problem and how you kind of conceptualize it. I mean, probably the one that is most controversial in a way is the dark energy question. And so one group of physicists, in some sense, define the problem away by saying, well, there's an extra kind of number or factor in our equation. All we actually need to explain is why it takes a particular value, which is very small. We don't need to explain more than the fact that this constant, cosmological constant, has a particular value. That's the kind of one of the controversial solutions. Other problems, I mean, string theory purports to be a theory that can unify quantum mechanics and gravity.
Why is it called string theory?
So the idea is the basic object is a string moving in 11 dimensions, and everything comes out of that. I think this is another thing that's controversial, is whether string theory really... Remember how I talked about the two pillars? Some people think that string theory doesn't really have all the basic structure of general relativity. It doesn't have some of the more beautiful symmetries of general relativity. But on the other hand, some people think the alternatives that are more centered around retaining all the basic kind of beauty of general relativity aren't as good enough at dealing with the problem of how you understand particle physics. And so in a sense, all the different solutions are kind of like a patchwork of taking different parts of the problem and trying to solve some bits and not others.
So now we're going to turn to our second chapter, which is to pick up one of the threads we've mentioned already concerning time and the problem of time, or perhaps the problems of time. You tell me, Karim, how many are there?
I mean, let's stick with two for the time being. So if you think about our perception of time or experience of time, there's really, I think, two very basic aspects of it. The fact that there is some kind of order or progression in time, and the fact that it's directed. The first one, where it goes in quantum gravity, and the second one, where it comes from. So why don't I start with the second one first?
So just to recap, as I understand it, the basic problems of time, of which there are two, is why does it have a direction and why does it exist at all?
Exactly. And so in both cases, the really kind of complex thing or difficult thing is the thing that we experience, the manifest image of time and the mathematics, don't seem to fit together. So in particular, it's been kind of noted that for a long time now, certainly since the 19th century, that the equations of physics don't have a direction of time, but our experience does. And so in the equations, you can see processes happening in both directions, but in the kind of experienced reality that we see and observe and measure, we only see one half of the story. And the kind of standard conventional way of trying to understand this is to kind of push things back. So why do we see an arrow of time on Earth? It's because of the sun. The sun is kind of very low entropy. It's very organized. And what we see unfolding as time here is somehow related to the organized energy of the sun being disorganized by the likes of us. But why is the sun so organized? Go back. The galaxy was organized. Go back. Eventually, you go to a very, very special initial condition, which people call the past hypothesis, that the universe started in a really, really special, smooth, organized initial state. So Roger Penrose has also got something called, he frames it in a particular mathematical way, which I think is quite interesting. He calls it the Weyl curvature hypothesis, which is a particular way of using general relativity.
Is this Weyl as in disgusting or Weyl as in vile?
Hermann Weyl is a, I guess, early 20th century mathematician.
Right, okay.
But the idea is if you start in a very special place, you can explain why you see the direction of time. So the second problem, the problem of time, this is going back to what we were talking about in the first part, this kind of perceived tension or incompatibility or problem when you put general relativity and quantum mechanics together. So I told you there's lots of problems, but if you just kind of bracket lots of those problems, most of those problems for the time being, and just apply the kind of standard recipe we have for turning a classical theory into a quantum theory, if you do this in the context of general relativity, what you find is that the symmetries of the theory, the particular way that theory in fact represents time, together with the recipe for turning it into a quantum theory, enforces the theory that you end up, the quantum theory of gravity, however it gets fleshed out in detail and in the other problem solved, is very likely not to have any time evolution at all. So it's not just that the equation doesn't have a difference between past and future, but the equation doesn't have any evolution whatsoever.
So what you're saying is when you put general relativity and quantum mechanics together, time disappears.
Exactly. At least according to the conventional approach. And this has been known really since the 1960s. And the equation which people think describes this timeless universe is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is kind of pretentiously called the wave function of the universe. And the problem is that the wave function of the universe, unlike the wave function in quantum mechanics, of the quantum theory of subsystems of the universe, the wave function of the universe in this framework doesn't evolve.
But we know it does, so something has to explain that.
So there are two ways of thinking. When there's something in our manifest experience that isn't reflected in the physics, there are two possibilities. The first possibility is that structure, that aspect of the world, does exist. It's just emergent. So someone like Carlo Rovelli says, no, of course there is time, but time doesn't exist at the fundamental level. It's a relative change within the wave function that creatures like us, at the scale like us, observe.
So what's the difference between a fundamental property and an emergent property?
It's a very good question. I mean, I don't think everyone's quite disputes the answer. I think probably the nicest explanation in the modern philosophy literature is that an emergent property is something that can play the right role at the right level. So, for instance, there isn't time in the basic equation, but parts of it look enough like time at a certain scale for it to play the role of time. So you think about how we actually understand time, right? For millennia, we used the rotation of the Earth as a proxy for time. So the idea is, just like that, there are ways of decomposing the equation such that at the kind of basic level, it doesn't have time, but you can get a kind of something to play,
right,
the kind of stand-in for time. And so this really goes back to kind of accepting. I remember I said there are two options. So we either accept that at the fundamental level, the structure isn't in the physics and try and take it out at the emergent level. The alternative, which is what I'm more kind of sold in, is to really go back, and this is my philosopher's training. When you have an argument, you don't like the conclusion, go back to the premises from which the conclusion that you don't like was derived. And remember I said that it all comes from a certain understanding of symmetry. So really the basic symmetry that we're talking about has a very silly name. It's called time reparameterization invariance. What does
just
that mean?
Trips off the tongue.
I mean, I'm dyslexic, so having to write an entire book where I spelt that over and over again was not very fun. So it's, in some sense, it's kind of like the symmetry of the fast-forward button. So if you imagine watching a film, one thing you could do is just jump everything in the film 5 seconds forward. Another thing you could do is fast-forward for a little bit, then on two times, then put it to normal speed, then put it to four times, then put it to three times. So if you imagine the progressive instance like this, the symmetry would be speeding up a bit here, a bit more there, a bit less there, however you like. So the idea is that if you're watching the movie of the universe, your fast forward button doesn't do anything, no matter when you press it, for how long. So the symmetry is that the equations are invariant under speeding up and slowing down time. And so the reason this is connected to the quantum theory goes back to Paul Dirac. And so Paul Dirac, really kind of hero of mine, he grew up in Bristol, where I currently live. And he's really quite an incredible physicist that I think probably deserves a bit more kind of to be lauded more in this country. Really, the only person I think who really seriously contributed to quantum mechanics, relativistic quantum theory, especially in the special theory, and to general relativity as well. And so he was working on this particular symmetry that I was talking about. And what he derived is a kind of mathematical framework in which this symmetry necessitates, at the quantum level, that you apply a particular procedure which leads to this timeless equation. And so what I want to do is go back to the argument to why we have to follow this particular algorithm and question whether it's actually the right way of going, so that time can actually kind of remain in the fundamental physics, so we don't have to lose it and then find it again. It's there all along. And so working with physicists, I've been developing an alternative approach where we kind of start from a different place and hope to keep time in the quantum theory as well.
Interesting. So you've mentioned this schism that became present between physics and philosophy. Maybe that's to overstate it slightly. But, you know, to take it back to the early modern period where physics would have been called natural philosophy, were these debates in any way, in any form, playing out then? For example, between disagreements between Newton and Leibniz over the nature of time?
Exactly. So, I mean, interestingly, philosophy of physics is, to some extent, all footnotes to Leibniz and Newton. So Leibniz and Newton didn't get on particularly well. A lot of this had to do with a very complicated dispute over the origin of the calculus.
I mean, I've heard a legend that, and sometimes Leibniz's name is still spelled with a T, but the legend has it that he dropped the T from his name in protest over Newton's absolute conception of time, when his was much more relativistic and perhaps in tune with yours, but, you know.
I mean, possibly. I mean, he may have also invented the biscuits, but I'm not sure. And so they had this dispute, and it got to the point by when they had this particular kind of debate, correspondence, where they weren't actually on speaking terms anymore. Luckily, they had a kind of double intermediary. So Caroline of Unsbruck, I think I'm pronouncing that right.
Women doing emotional labor all over again.
Apologies to any Germans. Leibniz was her tutor, and then she became the Princess of Wales and moved with the Hanoverian succession to become the English royal family. And so she was kind of interested in Leibniz's work, interested in Newton's work, and acted as a kind of conduit. But she actually had as a conduit to someone else called Samuel Clarke, who lived next door to Newton. But let's not get into that. And so what we do, we actually still teach this. We study the letters between them, which to some extent you can think of as letters between Leibniz and a Newtonian who's probably talking to popping around the corner to talk to Newton while he's writing the letters. And they argue about a lot of things. But one of the things that they particularly argue about is the nature of space and time. But really, and this is why we still study it and why it's so central, the arguments are all about symmetry. And Leibniz is a relationist, and he says, look, you say that the world is situated in space and in time, but you show me two worlds situated differently in space, and I show you a distinction without a difference. It's just the same world re-described. And Clarke, kind of on Newton's behalf, says, no, we have to count these as separate things because we can explain the world much better if we count these as separate things. And so one of the things they argue about is whether if the universe started at a different time, it should be a different universe. And so at this point, it's really not just physics and philosophy that are intermingled, but also theology. And so you really have this interweaving of very complex and interesting ideas that lead to this rich and productive discussion.
Philosopher of physics Karim Turbo with Sally Davies at the Sophia Club in London. Now we're talking mysteries of the universe, the when, the how it all works, and we've been trying to solve these questions for millennia. Men, women, and astronomers from diverse cultures, Islamic scholars, have been foundational. But in the modern West, Karim says that complete story is often missed.
This is a problem of physics, but of 3rd century AD physics. And that problem is reconciling the kind of observations of the cosmos, particularly according to the kind of framework put by an astronomer called Ptolemy and his followers, which actually included Hypatia, who's a really great Greek mathematician in Alexandria about 3rd century. And so they together had a framework that could describe the heavens fairly accurately, but it involved giving up one of the theoretical principles that was very important then, it's very important now, which is the principle of harmony. And so Aristotle thought that the natural motion of a heavenly body was regular circular motion. And in order to kind of reconcile their theory with what they observed, the Ptolemaic astronomers kind of did violence to that. They introduced this device that's called the equant, which is really a point in a circle about which the motion is regular. So it's not regular around the edge of the circle. And this is something that, particularly in the Renaissance, Western astronomers, particularly Copernicus, really didn't like. But what's interesting is that actually fairly, about 40 years ago, people discovered that there's some evidence that's fairly convincing that the device that he used to remove this equant, to restore harmony to the system of astronomy, was actually invented hundreds of years earlier by an Iranian mathematician astronomer called Al-Tusi, who was really interesting, kind of productive mathematician astronomer and kind of interpreter of Aristotle. And so I think there's an interesting sense in which the kind of story that we tell about the history of science is rather partial and incomplete. And in fact, it's really more of a kind of collaboration involving people outside the Western canon, and also far, far more women than are given credit in the way that conventionally these things are taught.
Is there someone there you're thinking of in particular? I mean, which we mentioned Marie Curie, but are there other women in the tradition?
So, I mean, going back to what we were talking about, the main theorem, the kind of fundamental result that ties together symmetries in all of physics is due to a woman called Emmy Noether, who in her time was a really famous and important mathematician. She was really taken seriously as a thinker of first rank by Hilbert, by Einstein. But she was later kind of, in a sense, written out of the story. So what you find is that she proves these two theorems that are fundamental to understanding how symmetry relates to particularly conservation principles. After her kind of the period in which she was actually active or where people knew her, people would prove less important, less general results, and then say that they generalized her theorem, and then not, in fact, go back and look at the results. So again, it's only relatively recently that people have kind of fully understood the kind of power and generality of her work, which was actually a sideline. She was mainly a pure mathematician. She worked in algebra. And it kind of, as a sideline, she wrote this paper that really is the cornerstone of the kind of our understanding of symmetry in physics still to this day.
Well, look, I'd really like to shift gears a little here and try, if at all possible, to bring us down to earth in some sense. So we've had this proliferation of problems, proliferation of paradoxes, perhaps the most pressing of which is the fact that, from what I've heard, physics and mathematics are fundamentally contradictory with our experience of time, our experience of the world. And so in trying to reconcile our perception of time, our perception of the universe as it is, and what science tells us it should be, is there some sort of route out of this? What can we, if there's one thing you want us to take away, one possible solution, one speculation, what would it be?
So I think, like with the other problems, often there's always a choice between trying to find the solution by saying that the thing that we take to be fundamental in our experience, the direction of time or time itself, isn't based there in the equations, but it comes out at this kind of effective level. And the kind of other strategy to say that, well, no, we should actually go back and look again at the equations and look again at how we're conceptualizing physics to try and find that structure. I talked about the problem of the arrow of time and the standard solution being choosing a very, very special initial state.
So this is like a little arbitrary number.
Exactly.
That, you know, there's no reason for it to be what it is. But
and so Penrose, in his wonderful book, I think it's Road to Reality, has a picture of God choosing some very special initial state.
It's not 42, is it? No.
I mean, it could be. It's as random as choosing 42, I suppose. And so, again, what I'm interested in, what I'm working, again, with physicists on, is an alternative. And so the alternative is to use another symmetry, a symmetry we haven't talked about, the symmetry of size. So if you imagine everything in this room was three times bigger, would we notice? If we were three times bigger, everything else was three times bigger? Possibly, possibly not. But certainly when we looked outside, we would see the difference that the church is now much smaller. But if you imagine everything in the universe being bigger, being rescaled, the claim is that could be a symmetry. The universe is scale invariant.
So if something is, in standard theories, if something is much bigger or much smaller than it is, do the laws of physics operate the same way or not?
No, they change. It's not a symmetry. So usually symmetries are things where if you change them, the predictions are the same. So standard views of physics, they have a preferred scale. So if you double all the lengths, you get different predictions. These theories, scale invariant theories, you promote that transformation, that property to being a symmetry. And strangely, what happens is that you find that you can actually then guess something more like directed structure in terms of time. And particularly, you get behavior that looks a lot like the effect of dissipation that you find in most simply an oscillator, imagine a pendulum, eventually the air resistance means that it's, instead of just going back and forth like that, it starts to wind down. And what you find is that if you take the equations of cosmology and you introduce this symmetry into the classical theory of cosmology, that scale no longer has physical meaning, the universe starts behaving more like a damped oscillator, and you get an hour of time kind of out of the basic dynamics of the cosmology.
So let me recap. What you're saying is that in these theories, and spoiler alert, this is the open universe theory, right, or the group of theories that consider the universe to be open, and we can come back to that. You're saying that scale, the size of things, no longer makes a difference to the operation of the laws of physics. And this means the universe starts behaving, you called it a dissipative system, right? So that's a system. What exactly is a dissipative system?
So on the kind of simple everyday level, it's really a system that loses energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might say this sounds strange. How could the universe lose energy? Where would the energy go? And so in the context of the universe, it's not really losing energy. There are other mathematical properties that are a bit like the behavior of a kind of gas as it dissipates that this cosmology has. The kind of way of thinking about it is that there's something that looks like friction. And so another part of my work is working with analogies in science. And so physicists are often quite practical people, and they need analogies to get a handle on things. And so there's a mathematical analogy between the equations that describe this dissipating universe and the equations that describe a system like a pendulum that's losing energy. But actually, in this case, it's not quite an exact analogy, but it helps us kind of conceptualize and understand what's going on.
So most cosmological theories implicitly assume the universe is kind of closed, that it's like it's like a box and there's nothing outside of it. And what you're saying is maybe more like the universe is kind of almost like a multi-dimensional Mobius strip that is somehow open to itself and creating friction with itself. Is that right?
There's different ways that we can think about it. So the kind of simplest way is really that when we describe the universe, we don't actually describe all that there is. What we're describing is the large-scale behavior of the universe. So the equations of cosmology describe, they're at the level that you can use the equations like the universe is a fluid. If you imagine a water, let's say, so water is made up of molecules. When we describe water as a fluid, we assume that the scale of a little box of fluid is such that we have billions of molecules, billions of billions of molecules in one box. So in this case, the box is a box of galaxies. And you kind of pretend or work, again, it's an analogy, use this equations that would describe a fluid. So there's one way you could think about the friction as being kind of friction into the kind of molecular structure of the galaxies. Where that would go, possibly into black holes. Black holes are also a system where we find something that looks a bit like dissipation. You find information in many approaches to black holes, information is being lost. So it could be the universe's friction with itself is really it losing information or losing entropy into black holes. That's one option. Another option is that it could just be an intrinsic property of the universe. So when we think about energy conservation, we know that things like at our scale, we know what energy means and we know what it is to conserve energy. But when we extend the concept of energy to the universe as a whole, we don't know that that's necessarily the right regime to apply that concept. And so although we don't understand energy as being lost in systems that are interacting with anything at the scales we're talking about, the idea that the universe could have the analog of dissipation is something basically we're pushing on. And I think this is maybe to go back to the relationship between physics and philosophy. Like I said, philosophy is very good at dealing with concepts. And when physics starts going into domains where we don't know how to use or understand the concepts anymore, that's when philosophers are really useful. So the open universe is as much a kind of way of, as a project that we're working with, of a group in Munich and physicists in Lancaster and a group in Bristol, what we're trying to do is work together to kind of create new concepts to talk using the language of open systems, like damped oscillators. There's also a whole framework talking about open systems and quantum mechanics. Use those concepts in the context of cosmology, where we don't quite know how to talk about things like the entropy of the universe or the energy of the universe. These are concepts that we have kind of trained in one kind of particular domestic regime, and we're trying to understand, work with the physicists to work out how, if we push them into this new regime, we can make sense of them. And there's different ways of doing this.
So you're saying even things like energy, it might not make sense to talk about it at the scale of the universe, even if it makes sense to talk about it in the context
exactly.
of the steam engine or the heat in this room, for example.
Exactly.
So why should we prefer your view of the open universe to standard cosmological views? What can we cash it out a bit? I mean, for example, what does it do to time when we consider the universe to be open in this way?
And maybe to go back, I think we shouldn't consider my view or this view on its own as being better. But I think one of the things that we should do in general is consider a more diverse range of options. So the physicist Lee Schmolin has this really nice idea that if we're trying to explore a landscape and we only have so many people and so much time, we wouldn't get one person to decide which direction to go in and everyone follow them. We'd split up into groups. And I think that's part of the idea, is just to prod and push the physicists into trying to explore more diverse strategies. So I think the strategy that we're pushing has some advantages. In particular, it has the kind of analog of dissipation, has an hour of time built into it.
So when you say analog of dissipation, this idea of heat being lost,
exactly,
the arrow of time, that is time moving in one direction,
exactly,
comes naturally out of that. Can you just explain that
a bit
more?
I mean, even more kind of strangely, some version of this approach, we actually get two arrows of time, not one. So Julian Barber calls this the Janus universe, after the Roman god Janus, who is the god of, I think, time and doorways. And Janus is usually pictured with two faces pointing either way like this. So in this model, what you may get in some versions of it, there are only really good results for very, very simple versions of this model so far. But it's likely to be the case in more complicated versions that the Big Bang will be replaced by something people often call a big bounce, but in this case would be quite disanalogous. Because what we would get is that our universe, if you imagine shaping like this, with the arrow of time going this way, would transition through maybe some kind of quantum transition into another universe like our own, but with the arrow of time pointing the opposite way, like the faces of Janus. And so we would actually, in some sense, have too much of a good thing. We'd not only recover an hour of time, we'd actually recover another hour, a further hour of time pointing away. And what's nice is that if you switch the hour of time, you get the same back. So there's a beauty and symmetry about this picture, which I really like, that the universe has 2 hours of time, so that it actually has time direction in each half, but is overall symmetric. So we get back to this idea of kind of symmetry and beauty and harmony. So we want to recover an hour of time, but we probably want to do it such that it respects these symmetries of the laws as well.
So what you're saying is, at the same time as our universe unfolding in time in one direction, there's a universe that is exactly the same as ours that's refolding itself.
So, I mean, this is where things get difficult, because we need to time to talk about the time when things are happening. So, I mean, I quite like to think about things in a way that Hugh Price, who I was lucky enough to work with in Sydney many years ago, talks about things, that we try and think of a view from no-when. We try and describe the universe all at once from some perspective where there is no time. What we would see is this kind of structure with what we could identify, or what people within the universe would identify as an arrow of time here, and people in the universe, arrow of time here. But there's a sense in which all of it exists at once when you look at it from outside of time. But from inside of time, you see what's around you. And so, I mean, good question. Could we get evidence for this? Maybe. If there was some ways in which the physical phenomena in the early universe on one side were quantum entangled with the other side, perhaps we could get evidence. Probably not in our lifetimes, though.
So there's an anti-Karim and an anti-Sally in this anti-universe asking themselves why time runs backwards, because that's the obvious thing to them.
I'm not sure. Possibly. I mean, I know it depends upon how statistical everything is. Things could be very different. Like I said, this is at the level of fluids. Me and you are the level of little tiny molecules bashing around. And so it may be that most of the things like us are completely different between the two. But it may be that we have doppelgangers pointing the opposite direction.
It offers quite a nice bridge to one of the questions that we had submitted, which is, what if Kant was right, that time is a form of intuition? Is this compatible with the time we see in physics?
So I'm not a Kant scholar. I confess it's heavy going for me.
Let's take this idea that time is somehow a product of the creatures we are, the way our minds work, some intuition we have.
I think that's undoubtedly true. But I guess my question really is, which aspects of time are kind of intertranslatable between different creatures that aren't quite like us? So, I mean, I think there's some interesting sci-fi about what it would be like to be a creature which had very, very different local environment. Perhaps they would perceive, we have creatures like this on Earth, perceives time very differently to us. And I think that's undoubtedly true. I think, though, however, there's a lot of what science does, I'm confident that a lot of what science does is latch on to kind of objective parts of reality, in the sense that there are features or patterns in the world that even creatures radically different from us would have something that correlates with it. So I think perhaps all creatures in all conditions would have something like time, but I would hope that if we met very radically different creatures at some time in the future, our stories about time and their stories about time would be able to translate between them.
Mm. It's a lovely image. Well, I'll throw open the floor at this point.
Hello, thanks so much. I'm interested in whether there, your Karim might be aware of any cultures or traditions in which time and space are not separated. And does that help in any way?
That's very interesting. I think the two examples I know of are not quite exactly that, but I think there is an idea about the way that Pacific navigators, who are the kind of most underrated navigators of all time, I mean, they really, Columbus said nothing on these guys, right? I mean, they really navigated huge stretches of ocean with very simple crafts. So I think they have, my friend who works on cognitive science was telling me that there is a framework for thinking about directionality as always, in space, as always based upon where you are. And so they can do dead reckoning in a way that Western navigators were never able to do. I do know that there's some, or many, many cultures that have cyclic notions of time. So that's in some sense the topology of time being quite different. I don't know about any cultures that have space and time kind of mixed together.
Yes, thank you very much. I think my question is about language. It's about the language of mathematics, because there seems to be an association between the impossibility of maths, the equations, coping with the idea of time, and yet everything that happens is a time event. And I'm wondering if this is a language problem and how we use maths as a way of understanding.
I guess the question is, what kind of language problem? I mean, maybe I could make a kind of differentiation between some problems that turn out to be pseudo-problems or not real problems once we really think how to think about them, and kind of substantive problems. I think the problems I'm talking about aren't about language, they're really about content. I mean, one example of a problem that I think could be a pseudo-problem is this idea of the flow of time. And so some people have this very, very clear sense that what they mean by the flow of time is something really precise. But what you find is that that isn't cross-cultural, and that some languages and some cultures really emphasize time as something that flows and the analogy of flow. And so then when you look at science and you don't find something that's flowy, there seems to be something missing. But other cultures and other people have experience in which that concept of the flow of time doesn't appear, and time having a direction is enough, but the kind of passage, the dynamical passage of time isn't something they feel is missing from science. So I think that could be that kind of problem.
So this would be, you know, the flow of time being this idea that time just moves continuously, like the cello, as opposed to notes on a piano that have like these discrete sort of differences. But you're just saying that's not, you think that's not really a problem.
I think this is why I think it's a pseudo problem, is that when you really try to explain what you mean by the flow of time, it's supposed to be something more than just a continuous sequence of moments. It's supposed to be some kind of objective passage of reality. And I think that's something that doesn't occur in the same way. It's very particular, possibly to the English language, or at least to some languages, to talk about time in kind of a way that you think almost like music or writing going from left to right, and there being a flow or passage. And so I think that, for me, is a problem that could be just a problem about language. But my hope or my confidence is that these problems about the directionality of time and whether there's time at all in the equations are really kind of more than that. They're more substantive.
So this is probably a naive question, but...
They're the best kind, don't worry.
Thank you very much. So if we think of biology and... development in different species and birth and develop the changes that occur and ultimately aging and death, can we just completely separate that from the notion of time? Because it seems to be so entangled in the way we think about our lives. Should we do that?
So look, I talked earlier about different fields interacting, interdisciplinarity. I also think sometimes we need to separate questions and also have like specialism and expertise. I work on time and physics. I don't think necessarily the same things we say about time and physics should be the story we say about time in every aspect of life and culture. And I think there is an important kind of difference to how we think about the experiential nature of time that is special and important and not reducible to the explanations we give in physics. I don't think physics has ever been in the business of explaining everything. So I think the stories we tell about our lives, our culture, our biological existence shouldn't be subsumed into the physics of time. And I really don't have enough expertise to talk about this more general question of time. For me, time's a little t in an equation. And some of that maps onto some of our experience of time, and it can explain some parts of it. And some of it, most importantly, maps into how we measure processes in the world. So we think it's something real because there's a correspondence between the equations and the world. But I don't think by understanding the arrow of time or time and quantum gravity, like the mysteries of time are solved. There's only a very small part of the problems of time. I'm sorry, that's a slightly disappointing answer, but I'm not going to give you an all-encompassing theory of time, because I think that's not necessarily the job of a philosopher of science, or a philosopher of physics, at least.
Well, nonetheless, I think we've got many generative potentials that I'm going to be stewing on and turning over in my head, I suspect, for weeks to come. So thank you all so much for coming.
And we're all out of time. The marriage between physics and philosophy today on Big Ideas. Yes, the very biggest of big ideas. Hosted by Sally Davies, executive editor of Eon Media. And she was speaking with Karim Turbo, a philosopher of science at the University of Bristol. This live philosophy event was presented in London at the Sophia Club from the creators of the wonderful Eon and Psych magazines. And you can find out more about the Sophia Club at sophiaclub.co. And they have them in Melbourne as well. And for more big, big ideas, check out our program archive on the ABC Listen app or over on the Big Ideas website. It's all there. Your brain will love you for it. And I love you for listening. Thanks. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.